You are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont. Today is Monday, March 30th. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Lori Alberts, author of fiction and creative nonfiction. Lori Alberts is the author of three novels, Lost Daughters, The Price of Land in Shelby, and Tempting Fate. A story collection, Goodnight, Silky Sullivan, and two memoirs, Faultline and Between Revolutions, an American Romance with Russia. Her craft book, Showing and Telling, Writing Vibrant Scenes and Essential Summaries, will be published by Writer's Digest Books in 2010. She has received a Michener Award for the novel, the Catherine Ann Porter Prize, the Pirate's Alley Faulkner Society Prize for Short Story, and an American Fiction Award, among others. Lori teaches fiction and creative nonfiction in the Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA and Writing Program. She has taught writing at the University of New Mexico and Hampshire College. Lori also freelances, offering one-on-one writing critiques, editing, and coaching with private writing students. She lives on a small farm with her husband and daughter. When we spoke in January, I first asked Lori what had inspired her to write her first novel, Tempting Fate.
I was working on another novel. I was in graduate school, and I wasn't doing very well with the other novel. And one day, a friend of mine in Alaska sent me a little book written by a woman I had known up there who had been a horrible drunk. And she had sobered up, and she wrote her little biography, autobiography. And it just memories and images of my time in Alaska and working on the fishing boats just came pouring back in. And I just started writing, and it became my first book, Tempting Fate. So it was years later, something just triggered all that vivid past for me. And then I went back up there and fished again. And
were you already writing stories at that point?
Or? I was writing stories and trying to start a novel.
Now, you bring up the fishing boats, and I had a question about that. I was just thinking, you know, that's such an extraordinary experience that you did that. You know how there's that old writer's adage, write what you know. Do you feel that somebody needs to have done something along those lines in order to write about something along those lines, you know?
To write about it authentically?
Mm-hmm.
Probably, yeah. Or they have to be awfully good at research. Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, historical novelists do it based on research, but we don't know if it's really authentic or not. Mm-hmm. We just can say whether it's convincing us. But nobody's popping up from 1790 to say, no, our buttons didn't fasten that way or something.
Do you tend to work on several projects at once, or do you focus on one thing at a time?
I've done it both ways. I tend to focus on one thing at one time, but when I've gotten really stuck, I've set something aside, done something else, then gone back to the first one. So I don't know if you'd call that at the same time, but I tend to switch off if I can't move forward.
You work in at least two genres that I know of, fiction and creative nonfiction. Do you write poetry as well?
No, I'm poetically challenged, I'm sorry to say.
When you work on a book full of characters, like your novel, The Price of Land in Shelby, how do you work to develop your characters? I mean, how do you get to know them so that you can write about each person as an individual? I suppose in any novel, but particularly with so many characters.
Well, in part, basing bits and pieces from various people in the world. But also, I think of it as kind of like an acting exercise where I have to become them. I have to will myself inside them. And often, just as an exercise, even though that book was all written in the third person, I would sit down and write first person from that person's point of view to try to find my way into their feelings.
Right, okay. You just mentioned that, like an acting exercise. Have you acted? Have you been in the theater? Did you used to do that?
No, but okay. I actually taught a acting for writers and writing for actors class with a friend of mine who was a playwright, and it was a blast. So I got to see all the exercises that she did with people to get them into characters.
Did you have any ideas for exercise for writing after that? Or?
You know, it's more just a process of thinking my way in or feeling my way in. But I think that you pick, even if it's somebody completely different from you, for instance, in my first book, Tempting Fate, one of the main characters is a 25-year-old Native American guy. And I took out a piece of some of my own history and planted it in him. Of course, we're completely culturally different and different backgrounds. But I think that's how you find your way in. Another example is I was writing about an African-American woman and really timid about it and feeling that I wouldn't get this right. And then I gave her a child with a problem that was similar to a problem my daughter had had. And I felt our connection. So I guess I reach for that, the meeting point, even though I write about people, men a lot of times, people very different from myself, different experiences. But I also eavesdrop a lot and listen a lot. That was the case with my husband's family. I was just around them a lot, and I didn't really understand them. And I wrote myself into the characters that I picked pieces of their lives for, but they weren't exact replicas or anything, as a way of understanding them. So I might have got them all wrong, but that was my way of understanding.
Speaking of eavesdropping, sometimes I'll try to eavesdrop in a public situation just to pick up on how dialogue flows. And I always feel very self-conscious about, like, writing down what people are saying at the
table.
They
don't know you're doing it.
They really don't, do they? I'm always worried somebody's going to catch me at it. Hey,
what would they be doing looking over your shoulder
exactly.
at your writing? It'd be just as bad.
So what was your inspiration for The Price of Land in Shelby?
Marrying into this seven-generation Vermont family, definitely feeling like someone from another planet in a lot of ways. But my husband was very close to his family and trying to figure out what their lives were like and getting to know them and trying to find out what I didn't know. That was the beginning of it. But then, of course, I started, as all fiction writers do, taking all kinds of liberties and going in different directions and making things up.
Yeah. Has any one of your books been more difficult for you to write than the others?
Absolutely. Fault Line.
I wondered about that. Yeah.
My first memoir. Oh, that was a killer. That was really a killer.
Was it cathartic or was it just hard?
You know, my husband asked me the same thing. At the end, he said, well, you must feel really purged of all of this. And I said, no, I don't. It's still right there. Yeah. I thought it would be something that I would free myself from, but it was just something I had to do. But no, it wasn't really cathartic. It was grueling, grueling. And I imagine it was grueling for my husband and daughter, who was pretty young at that time, to be around someone who was that much in another mindset and in the past.
And the basic premise of Fault Line is that an old boyfriend with whom you'd had a pretty serious relationship became homeless at a certain point after you'd broken up, and he was found dead.
Decomposed, yeah.
Yeah, and he was out in the middle of the desert, is that correct?
It was the Wyoming High Prairie.
Okay.
In fact, I'm going to read from that.
Oh, okay.
But what was so hard was my own sense of guilt and my own sense of responsibility, and that was kind of what drove me, was trying to figure out what my responsibility had been in his destruction.
Uh-huh. Well, maybe this would be a good time for you to read then.
Okay.
So this is Laurie Alberts reading from Fault Line. And who published Fault Line?
University of Nebraska Press, the American Life series. And this is right from the beginning. I guess you could sort of a prologue. A rancher and his six-year-old daughter, riding fence, found Kim's body. He'd taken off his clothes as he staggered along, strewn them behind him. In his discarded jeans, his wallet held plenty of cash. The temperature was over 100 the day he died, with a hot wind blowing, but the body lay with knees drawn up, shrunk into a fetal curl. At night, the temperatures plummet on the high Wyoming prairie. He lay out there 10 days, not missed, unnoticed, and with the heat and the wind and the animals, there wasn't much left to identify. The little rancher girl will not likely forget that picture, parchment stretched and torn over skeleton. To identify the body, the authorities had to rely on an X-ray, taken earlier that year when Kim fell and broke his hip outside a cheap suburban Denver motel. But that was only after they called his brother, Mark, a Broomfield, Colorado policeman, because the car was registered to Mark's address. Kim had no address of his own. I recognized him from the Colorado Rockies cap, Mark said. I bought that cap for him. We were in a Payless store, and he kept picking it up, looking at it, putting it down, and finally I said, come on, Kim, I'll buy it for you. He was like a little kid. Mark is a powerfully built 47-year-old man with light eyes and a tanned face. He competed seriously in rodeos for many years, but roping gave him arthritis in his hands. He intends to retire from the police force in a few years and buy a working ranch. I went back to rule out foul play, Mark explained. I tracked him by the receipts. He had released himself from a hospital with severe dehydration. He was in because he'd been found unconscious in a parking lot in Kimball County, Nebraska. He always carried his fishing and camping gear in his car. He camped near lakes and streams. He'd been to Hawk Springs before, but this time there were monsoon rains and Kim got the car stuck. He'd taken the gate off the dam road and tried to drive across it. There was evidence that he'd struggled to free the car, clothing stuck under the wheels, before he decided to walk out to the road overland. He'd broken his hip in a fall not that long ago, and it was still bothering him. He was jaundiced and gaunt. He was only 45, but he looked like a 70-year-old man. He got 2 miles before collapsing. He only had a mile to go, but he knew what he was doing. He was headed straight for the highway. A ranch hand astride a small cow pony moving cattle just outside Hawk Springs State Recreation Area reported to me. I noticed the car, but I didn't think nothing of it. It was there quite a while. I figured somebody'd gone for help. The car, a late model Saturn, had belonged to Kim's mother, who had died less than a year before. It held fishing equipment, sleeping bag, tent, Gatorade, the bottle of Librium they'd given him for the DTs when he released himself from the hospital. The right number of pills had been taken, Mark counted. There were tapes, Simon and Garfunkel, the Beatles, music of the 60s. It also held a small box that he carried wherever he went, his reading glasses, his dead father's watch, notebooks filled with Kim's tiny, even handwriting, a Swiss Army knife, and one photograph, a snapshot taken in 1970 at the Cheyenne Mountain Zoo. The young man in the picture wears white jeans, a button-down shirt, and the fatigue jacket he got in ROTC camp. He clamps a pipe between his teeth, a 20-year-old college boy's affectation. The pipe draws in his already lean cheeks, accentuates his high cheekbones, predicting the gauntness to come, but incongruous against the childish cap of blonde hair. His eyes look startled. He half turns from one of the animal cages. A bit to the side, but in the foreground, stands his teenage girlfriend. Her center-parted hair falls straight over her shoulders, black against the pale salmon of her trench coat. Though she's much smaller, she looms in front of the young man, commands attention with a bemused half-smile, nearly a smirk, with which she greets the camera. The boy is Joseph Kimbella, about to begin his senior year at Harvard. The girl in the photograph is me. See that? I've already turned the story so that I am center stage. I can't help staring into that camera with Kim as my backdrop. It occurs to me that I may not be the most reliable narrator for this tale. How can you know if I was at the center of Kim's destruction? But if I don't tell this story with all my biases, there is no one else who will. Anyway, it isn't his story but ours. When I learned of Kim's death 8 months after the fact, I couldn't stop crying. I cried so hard for so long that my daughter, not yet three then, begged me to stop. Just think about how nice me and Daddy are to you, she suggested. After 2 weeks of my unrelenting grief and endless expressions of disbelief, not just that Kim was dead, but that a man in whose strength I still fervently believed could have ended so diminished, my husband grew impatient. After all, I'd had no contact with Kim for 10 years, or so he thought, but he didn't know my secret. Even now, years after Kim's death, every day, sometimes as many as 3, 4, 10 times, I silently invoke his name. I've done so all my adult life. It is as reflexive as a believer calling out to Jesus or a soldier in a trench crying for his mama. He is my mantra, my shield against humiliation and fear. Kim, I say silently, or sometimes, I need you, Kim. Though I am married, a mother, it is possible that his will be the last name on my lips at the moment of my death. I don't want him to be. I love my husband and my child. Kim is an abstraction, yet unshakable. I have kept him at a distance, but kept him close, too, internal as blood, as threads of tissue and bone. They say that the lead we consume as children, which our bodies mistake for calcium, stays in our bodies forever, passes from our rushing blood to our skeleton, our silent grinding teeth. In this way, he became part of me, not a poison like heavy metals exactly, but embedded in the structure that carries me around and allows me to consume the days. Mistaken for nourishment, his is an exacting weight.
Thank you for reading that.
Welcome.
How did you meet him?
He was the Harvard student bartender, and I was the hot hors d'oeuvre girl. at a cocktail party in the town I grew up in outside of Boston, Lexington.
Oh, okay. So how, when you read it now, and you've read it, I'm sure, many times for various interviews or readings, how has it changed for you?
It's kind of dead for me now. I guess that's what happens when you write things that
when
have
a
lot
over
of power. Yeah, I can't say that I felt happily purged at the end of it, but when you start getting involved in turning emotion to craft, eventually it takes the emotion out of the words.
Hmm.
So it's your loss, and you hope it's somebody else's gain.
Mm-hmm. I've always wondered about that with musicians when they go to sing something particularly painful. It's like, how do they maintain their composure? You know, I suppose it's just, that's become craft to them, that song. Well, thank you for reading that.
You're welcome.
You are fluent in Russian?
Not at all.
You're
no,
not?
No. No, I was conversational in Russian.
Okay.
My grammar was pretty bad. I could make myself understood, and I could understand people.
And you lived there for a period of time.
I lived there forever. I went there nine times.
Nine times?
Nine times. The first time I was a teacher on an so-called exchange. It was only an exchange in one direction at that time. They weren't allowing their teachers to come here.
Oh. Okay.
A lot has changed since the Brezhnev days.
So what was the longest period of time you stayed there?
One semester. Then I came back the following summer, and then I just kept going back for...
I know that you've talked about putting a foreign language into prose, mm-hmm. you know, into English prose, and I'm just curious if you can talk about that a tiny bit, like how you approach putting enough in that it makes it sort of realistic to the subject, but not too much.
Well, I remember as a kid, I would read rather adult books, and I was always resentful when they would throw in French that at that stage of my life I didn't understand. And with the assumption that all educated people would understand it. And as someone who, in my Russia book, used quite a bit of Russian for color, really, for feel, for sound, I had to work at finding a way to make it understandable by context or just following it up with a few words that a little bit of a translation and try to keep it graceful and integrated, which isn't easy. I looked at a lot of other people using foreign languages to see how they did it, and you can't put in too much.
Right. Can you think of someone else that you think did it particularly well?
One book that did it really in an interesting way, sort of the opposite of what we're talking about, is Henry Roth's book, Call It Sleep. It's all in English, but you learn... This is really not exactly parallel, but it's a very interesting case. You learn... The mother is actually speaking Yiddish, but you're not quite aware of that. And she speaks... This is turn-of-the-century New York immigrants. And she speaks in a very metaphorical way, which I guess is natural to Yiddish, and quite beautifully. But at one point, the little kid runs away, and he gets picked up by the cops. And when she shows up at the cop station, she starts speaking what you then realize is English, and it's horrible. It's, you know, it's mispronounced, and it's broken. And you realize what she's lost by losing her own language, by being in a country where her own language doesn't work in settings, certain settings, and how diminished you feel for her, how you feel that she has been diminished by this not being able to speak in her own language. Mm. And it just hits you. And it's very powerful.
Yeah, that's a wonderful way to make that transition so that you understand what's been real up until now.
Yeah.
Wasn't what you thought was
and
real.
Then when the little kid is out on the street with the other little kids, he speaks this horrible street, you know, toy street kind of language, Goyles and, you know, Brooklyn accents from the turn of the century.
Right.
And so there's all these levels of language that the little boy is living within. Uh-huh. It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
I am fascinated by that whole business of layers of different languages and how we talk with one person and how we talk with another person.
Hmm. Back to The Price of Land in Shelby for a little bit. It takes place in Vermont during the 70s and 80s mostly. And the hardships of living here at that time contribute, I think, to the characters' situations and their choices. And as such, I thought that landscape played a very important part within that book. And I'm just wondering, is setting something you work hard to perfect?
I don't think it's something that I work hard to perfect. I think it's a natural, important aspect to me because place is very important to me in my own life. And I have moved for place, you know, a number of times, living in Alaska, living in Russia. And the landscape is just part of the story to me. And of course it would be for the people in The Price of Land of Shelby. So, you know, I might have to remind myself, okay, more details here or something like that. But in general, it's pretty natural. There are other aspects that aren't as natural for me, but that's one of the ones that's
natural.
Comes
more naturally. Yeah. So what doesn't come so naturally?
Plot. Character comes naturally to me, inhabiting characters. But dramatic tension, plot, the sort of action male aspects of writing, which are also important, are not as easy for me. I don't want to say that my books don't have events in them, because they do. But events aren't what capture my initial interest.
Mm-hmm. Although your books are full of scenes where a lot is happening, and the way that characters portrayed is how they react or act within situations. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I would.
I mean,
but
I don't find your characters at all passive or in their heads too much.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, because I don't often write about, strangely enough, I don't write about people who were raised exactly as I was, with, you know, a certain high level of education, all that, because I find that a pretty boring environment. So I've been more interested in my life by people who are up against things, who can do things with their hands, who are people of action.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be why it seems that way to you.
Mm-hmm. Where did you grow up?
I lived in southern New Hampshire till I was 9, and then my mother was very worried that the schools weren't good enough for me and my siblings, and she moved us to Lexington, which my father hated because he was still working in New Hampshire, just outside of Boston. So I made it there through graduating high school, and then I left.
Okay.
Went out west.
One thing that I found about The Price of Land in Shelby is, you know, some of these stories are very difficult, very sad, or there's a lot of anguish in these characters' lives, and yet you maintain this sort of underlying strength and hope within these, particularly these siblings that are all, you know, whose stories are being told. Did you have to go through many drafts to kind of find the tone of the piece?
No. No, what interested me about those characters was, despite everything that they had to deal with, and some pretty ugly stuff, there was this desire to reinvent themselves,
mm-hmm.
some more than others. And that fascinated me, the idea that doesn't matter, you know, whether you drop out of high school or whatever, they're just some people who are going to keep trying on different lives and trying to get it right. And I admire that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The overall tone, well, I wrote them separately. I was pregnant and then had a newborn when I was writing that book, and I think maybe that's why I worked in those units. I didn't write them in the order that they are in the book.
Mm-hmm.
If the tone is continuous, even though it's through a lot of different perspectives, I guess that's good, but they are all in the same environment,
right,
and the same family.
I mean, there's just this sense that, you know, there's struggle and there's hardship, but it's never depressing. I mean, there's the sense that they will be there for each other, and that they are, you know, even when they're fighting and stuff, there's like a certain support network within these people's lives.
It's about all they had.
Right. Well, and it came through, and it just felt very hopeful. And I think that that helps in a book that's got a lot of sadness and hardship in it. It helps the reader to get through it, to have this kind of like sense of hope and strength.
You read it that way, and I wrote it that way, but I did hear from other people that they thought it was just horribly depressing, and that,
really?
You know, there's no redemption. And so I wasn't going to come out and point out the
look
the
on
thing,
page 212.
Right, there's a good moment. No, I felt it was clear, but it wasn't clear for everyone, which is the way it always is when you get reviews or people write you ugly letters. I did get some hate mail.
You're kidding.
No, I got some mail from my town, but also from strangers that I was maligning Vermont.
Oh, wow. See, that's so interesting to me, because I'd almost feel like you were paying homage to Vermont, you know, and how hard it is to live here and trying to make a living in certain economic times, things like that. But
I got people told me that I was maligning Alaska in my first book too, so I mean, there are people that want to keep a romanticized view of things, and I'm not interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I offend people's romantic views. However, I have to say, within my own town, it wasn't about romantic views. It's about dirty laundry or whatever.
Okay. And now you're still in that same town?
I am.
How's it going?
Well, you know, out of a sense of guilt, I joined the fire department. And I worked in the volunteer fire department for a year and a half, and then I joined a rescue. I became an EMT for a while. And I felt I kind of did my penance, and people saw that. And I tried to put something back into the town. You know, one thing about Vermont, as you know, is it's kind of a live-and-let-live place.
Yeah. I remember when I talked to David Budbill, he talked about the reaction to Judah Vine, and that there was a very similar reaction. There were very, very negative reactions to Judah Vine, and people feeling that he had been stereotyping Vermonters and taking their stories away from them. And, you know,
when I wrote about the town in Alaska that I lived in, fictionalized, you know, fictionalized characters and everything, I still heard through the long distance grapevine that not only were people whose lives I had picked pieces from were upset, but people who weren't in it were upset.
Why wasn't I in it?
So I kind of accepted that you're going to always have your detractors and your appreciators, and mm-hmm. you just have to make it as real and true as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to please people, especially parents, family members, whatever, you're not going to write.
But you know what? It's hard enough to be a writer without getting hate mail. That would really, really get to me.
They don't come directly to you. They go to your agent or to your publisher. And although now anybody can find anyone if they want to. But I did get some scary mail from the first book.
You just mentioned agents. I'm just curious, do you work with an agent?
Yes, I have the same agent I've had since my first book.
And how did you find your agent? Did you just do cold call queries? Or
I did. I was sending things around. I remember one agent after 7 months couldn't remember if she'd read it or not. You know, it was just really tough, worse than getting published. And I have to give my graduate program credit for this, because some agents came out there and they actually recommended me to her, and we hit it off.
What to you constitutes a satisfying conclusion to a story or a novel? Using story in the larger sense, I guess.
I don't know if I can make a general rule about what is satisfying, because it really depends on what came before.
Yeah.
I don't want it tied up. I don't want any neat bows, or I'm not satisfied. But I don't want to get to the end of it and think, what was that about? Somewhere in between, where I have a sense of, I guess that up to the last minute, that I felt there's something, that I'm in this real world that I've given myself over to.
Mm-hmm. You know, you hear people who say that they were unhappy with something that didn't have a happy ending. You know, that they are dissatisfied with a read when it's not a happy ending. And that's exaggeration. But makes me think, well, what is a satisfying ending if you can't have a happy ending?
One thing, like, there's a novel I read a few years back that just really, really moved me. It was called To Find Balance by Rohinton mm-hmm. Mystery. And the ending was actually kind of heartbreaking, but it was satisfying in that I got to see what time did to these people mm-hmm. and where they ended up. And it was rather a surprise where one of them ended up. So that was satisfying. But I can't separate that from the fact that there was a rather epic quality to that novel, and it took them. It was all set during the time of Indira Gandhi.
Mm-hmm.
The whole range of society, from the untouchables to privileged people, and how they interacted, and it was just a beautiful novel.
When you start a new project, do you set goals for yourself as far as two things? First of all, like where you sort of hope that this goes. Not necessarily as plot goes, but sort of what the arc will look like of the story. And the second thing is sort of just getting the work done and how long it will take you and how much of it you will write in certain periods of time. Do you set those kinds of goals for yourself?
No.
Nope.
No.
Neither one.
No. But again, each work was different. With Lost Daughters, I knew the ending, and I wrote to get to that end.
You did know the ending.
I did know the ending. That's what made me want to write that book, provoked. It's something some little thing I had read, which just kind of blew into something big in my head. Price of Land and Shelby, not being as plot-driven, I just did it piece by piece, and it took me a while to figure out I was writing a novel. I was just writing stories at that point. My first novel, I had thousands of pages of outlines and notes. Shelby, I kept in my head. You know, it's...
Right.
But I never say, I need to get this many pages done by a certain time. No, just try to do it right.
So are you fairly self-directed in your work?
There's nobody standing there saying, we need this book now. So I must be self-directed.
Okay. Yeah. Do you write every day when you're home and not teaching?
No. No. At times, when I'm deeply in a project, yes, life gets in the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a kid and do a lot of carpooling, and I have a job. And the best times, my most productive times, I've been able to write 5 days a week. But I found you can accomplish a lot in smaller chunks here and there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you hear people say write every day, and then to me, you sort of like take that and translate it into, you know, set a schedule for yourself and keep to that. You know, whatever that needs to be.
I dream of that, being that disciplined, but I'm a little more scattered than that. I do think, though, that it's very hard when you're in something like something long, like a novel, to sit down and recreate that world. You're living your one life, and then you have to live your novel life, and to have to recreate it all over again, it's much easier if you're doing it every day.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a couple of days off, then you have to work to get back into that place that you were. And that's hard. That's really hard.
You were talking about how you did the pieces of The Price of Land and Shelby in separate sections. Did you publish those as standalone pieces?
No, I didn't.
Did you want to or try to?
I published one. I did publish one. I forgot. I did. My idea was, I'll drum up all this interest, but even the pieces were kind of long for stories. I started out like most young writers writing stories, but my stories kept getting longer and longer and longer until they turned into novels, and even the chunks I had in there, they weren't completely standalone. They depended on each other.
Yeah. What are you working on now?
Well, I've been doing some short things. I have an essay that's going to come out in Seattle Review, and a personal essay. And I did write a short story first time in 15 years, because I'm partly through the novel and just having a really hard time with it this time. Mm. It's very daunting to me. And I think it's good to just pick up and do shorter things while I'm fighting this fight with myself about whether to continue it or not.
Mm-hmm. And how are the shorter things going?
I've enjoyed them. I would like to do some more. I'd like to write some more personal essays. That's something that I love teaching. I love reading. But I haven't done too many of them on my own because I've always been long-winded and do full-length books, you know, two memoirs. But I like the form, and I'd like to do more with it.
Now, you teach, and you have a family, and you write. So
and I edit.
And you edit?
I freelance, teach and coach and edit, and I've done some books for people.
So that's a lot.
And I'm doing a craft book.
Oh, wow.
I've been commissioned to do a craft book.
That's exciting.
And that's going to take a lot of time, too. So where the creative stuff goes during that period, I'll have to... Maybe I'll just work on short things during that, in between.
Yeah. So my question was going to be, how do you schedule your time? But it's almost...
I don't. That's, I know
that's
it's
what
hard
I just said.
I know. It's hard to explain how anything gets done. I tend to, if I have a full day to myself, school's going on or whatever, I tend to put it into chunks. Like in between, in the chunks, I'm going to ride my horse. You know, I can only sit still for a couple hours at a time. I'm just not capable of sitting still for much longer or staring at a computer. So I'll get up and ride or go for a walk or all these things that my husband thinks I'm so lucky to get to do while he's out there working. But, you know, when my daughter's been home, she's, Daddy, you just don't get it. Mommy does work all day. She just does it in these chunks, and that's kind of how I do it. I do it in units. So a couple hours here, and then I do something physical, and a couple hours there, and I do something physical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or carpooling, you know, errands, the kind of normal stuff of life.
Right. Do you carry a dictaphone or anything in the car?
No, I don't even keep a journal anymore.
No?
Yeah, I found my journals very useful in tempting fate. I'm glad I had journals from when I was a teenager and journals for some of my years with that man. But no, I don't.
You said you called Faultline your first memoir. Have you been working on another memoir?
I published another one.
Oh, what was the other one?
It's called Between Revolutions, an American Romance with Russia. It's set in Russia.
When did you publish that?
I think it was the year after or 2 years after Faultline.
I said I was never going to, after Fault Line, I said, I'm never going to write another memoir, and then I'm only going to write fiction because you can hide behind the veil of fiction, and then I went and wrote another one. But that one I had tried to write as a novel years ago. And
about a teacher in Russia? Is that what it's basically?
Yes, except it's not about the teaching per se. It's more about this romance.
In the life, okay.
This relationship I had with a Russian. Uh-huh. That's what my husband says. No more old boyfriend books. These, you know, many, many years ago.
He must be a great guy.
He is. He's, you know, as long as it's something that happened before we were together, then that's the past. Hmm. But he doesn't want to read anymore.
Enough.
Yes, so I have this other memoir. Now I am writing fiction again.
What writers have influenced you, either personally or through their works?
Well, different writers for different periods of my life. There was a time when I was doing some graduate work in English before I went to an MFA program, and I was just miserable. The way I was being taught didn't appeal to me. The writers didn't appeal to me. I mean, 19th century British just didn't do it for me. And I started reading, same period, but Russians. So I read a lot of Russians. I read. I never was as big on Dostoevsky as I was on, say, Chekhov or Turgenev. The quote-unquote more minor Russians had more meaning to me. Also, Isaac Babel.
Mm-hmm.
He lived through the same pogrom in Odessa that my grandmother lived through as a five-year-old. So it was kind of a way to find out about her, but also he wrote about being in the Red Army as they're invading Poland. I became very involved in Russia, and I eventually ended up going to Russia, as I had said. So at that period of my life, it was finding a literature that spoke to me. It was some weird mixture of sentiment and violence, just felt more, and an enormous landscape, felt closer to my feelings about the United States than British literature, which is small and cultivated and about class.
Mm-hmm.
So that was important to me. Then when I was starting my first novel, I was really involved with Robert Stone's writing because he tends to have a braided narrative with three different points of view in a lot of his books, and I didn't know how to do that. So I would study him. So then that was because it was more less literature and more craft. But I started studying different writers for craft. When I was in college, I remember it was Grace Paley. So at different times, different people have inspired me for different reasons.
Right. Now, when you read the Russians, did you read in Russian or did you read
No,
in
I'm too lazy. I had to have a dictionary. I mean, I took Russian classes where we had to do some reading in the original, but no, I have to depend on not the kindness of strangers, but the
translations of strangers.
The translations of strangers, right.
What are you reading now?
I am reading Stephen Carter's New England White, which is kind of a mystery set in academia. It's by an African-American writer about kind of different class levels in African-American society, so that there's the Klan, sort of the old families, the equivalent of the old families. I don't usually read mysteries, and it's a really long book. So I'm getting near the end, and I really want to know what happened. And before that, I read Obama's book, Dreams from My Father, and I thought it was really well written.
Somebody else said that just the other day.
It was, and it also struck me with his ability to empathize with all kinds of people. He was constantly putting himself in their situations in his mind, which I thought was kind of reassuring. And when he gets to the part where he actually meets his family in Africa, he goes to Africa for the first time and spends time with them and gets involved with their lives, it's beautiful. Mm. It's really beautifully written.
Mm.
So that was the big book of my recent weeks.
Well, my last question. What advice might you have for writers who occasionally get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward?
Well, for people who really can't move forward at all, I have what I call the half-hour method. I've developed the half-hour method. The half-hour method is that when I haven't been able to work on something for a long time for whatever reason, because of other complications in life or work or whatever, or I'm stuck and I can't bear to write anymore, then I say to myself, well, I can stand to sit here for half an hour. Even if I just turn on the computer and twiddle with it or something for half an hour, I can put up with that. And I do that over and over again for half an hour, and then I let myself get up. And then after a while, of course, you start kind of fiddling around and just playing and writing whatever, and it has always added up after a while.
Wow. So when you say over and over again, you mean day after day?
Day after day, just sit there and do your half hour. So that's, I'm not going to hate myself after half an hour, I'm done hating myself.
Yeah, you don't let yourself read or do anything else.
This is apart from all the, you know, all the cleaning the drawers, answering email, all that stuff. None of that counts. The half hour is the half hour.
You just sit in front of your computer for half an hour. That's wonderful.
Yeah, that's it. Half an hour. Oh, but you can stand almost half an hour of anything, right?
Right. It's like you've been sent to the corner.
It does seem to be a way to get back into the habit of sitting, which you have to be able to do. It's hard. It's hard just to stay still and sit.
Mm-hmm. That's great advice.
I've had students try it, and it's helped them. At other periods in my life when it's just been lack of confidence, which I think is the biggest problem for writers, just feeling I can't do this, I had to tell myself things like, well, you know, babies, when they're learning to walk, they don't fall down and say, I'm lousy, I'm never going to walk. I might as well give it up right now, which is what we do as writers. So I have to keep reminding myself, you know, of those things. I have to do this, like, trick myself into letting go of the results, because I can write the bad review before the book's ever written.
And anyone can stand a half an hour.
Half an hour. Are you going to try it?
I am. Thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thank you. It was fun.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Lori Alberts. Listen again next week to hear an interview with Margot Livesey, author of 6 novels, including The House on Fortune Street, and fiction editor of the journal Plowshares. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group, and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. More information is available at autismsupportdaily.com or at 802-985-8773. Today's Write the Book prompt is offered by my guest, Lori Alberts. Lori suggests writing about 2 characters, one an adult, the other a child. They can be based on real people, or they can emerge completely from your imagination. Have them travel together to visit the adult character's childhood home. Write 2 scenes about what they might see in 2 different seasons. Once on a midwinter day at dusk, once in midsummer during a sunny day. Write from the point of view of the adult or the child, or one each, or write from an omniscient point of view. Let the exercise bring out some of the emotions that a visit back home can evoke. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can once again stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Our stream is once again functional. We're happy to report. And as always, archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont.